Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to the MedTech Talk Podcast. This is your host, Jeff Pardo, and to kick off 2023, it's my pleasure to bring back the last guest of 2022, Fred Kasrabi. During that podcast, Fred and I had a fascinating discussion covering Fred's background and his initial entry into MedTech. In fact, it was such an engaging conversation that we didn't get to cover some of the most important aspects of Fred's entrepreneurial career. So it's with great pleasure that I welcome you back to the podcast, Fred, and looking forward to picking up where we left off.
Jeff, thank you so much for having me again. I'm really excited to be in this part two with you. I enjoyed the conversations the first time, and great to be back with you. And if you allow me just right off the bat to wish a happy 2023 to everyone, that it's actually a healthy and productive new year for your audience. Hoping for stability in the world and more togetherness in the United States than the division that we've all seen. The U.S. continues to be a beacon of democratic values and rule of law with all of our issues that we see around us. It is for the rest of the world. And wishing for less racism and anti-Semitism globally. I wanted to also give a little bit of a shout out to the brave Ukrainians who have reminded us in 2022 what it's really meant to defend one's freedom from ruthless aggressors without. And also another shout out to another great courageous group of people, the Iranian people and their brave women and minorities, for showing us what it really means to defend one's freedom from more despotic aggressors, if you will, within. And so a very happy New Year to everybody, and shout out to all those people who are courageous and fighting for freedom.
Well, thank you, Fred. That's so well stated. And indeed, let's hope 2023 brings progress for Ukraine, Iran, and everyone across the globe. There's no shortage of challenges we face. And at least in our small entrepreneurial world of MedTech, we can do our part, but really share your feeling on the larger topics around us. But to kick things off, in the last podcast, we discussed opportunity versus preparedness. And it's such an interesting way of looking at things. And I wonder if we could start back there and have you frame that concept a bit before we talk about the rest of your experience.
Yeah, Jeff, I'd be happy to. I actually tell my daughter this all the time, that opportunities are all around us all the time. It's really up to us to be able to see them first and be able to grab onto them. And with preparedness, I think, comes both a better judgment to be able to discern these opportunities and better perception in being able to actually grab onto them if one is so willing. I'm sure your audience knows this old adage that says the eyes can't see what the mind doesn't know. And so preparedness for me is the eyes, and the mind is basically a source of action. And so I think the two together is what really brings this concept of preparedness and opportunity together.
Yeah, it's such an interesting way of putting it. And just to delve a bit deeper into that, what are some of the key elements of preparedness from your point of view?
I think we talked about it a little bit in the last podcast, that one of the, probably the most important one for me is, and I sound like a little bit of a broken record because I always talk about this, is building one's own board of directors. These are people who care enough about you to be constructively critical with you to really try to elevate you and be able to provide some of that seeing the things that allows your mind to actually react to. And the thing that I want to maybe talk about here that may be useful, other than just the cliche of building your own board of directors, basically, is to make sure your audience knows that it's you can't really preemptively go out there and pick and choose and create an ideal personal board of directors. Basically, it's only in the middle of the action that you get to find the people that you want to be in with for the rest of your life, so to speak. You have to be generally focused on the right things. They have to be generally focused on the right things. You monitor those people around you, actually have those shared values that can actually help you out. Assess their willingness they're willing to actually spend the time on you and adopt you and do it with a great deal of sincerity because they're interested in you. And then take some risk together and see how thoughtfully, how daringly, how consistently that mentor is a real mentor to you. I think taking risks to me, with somebody to me, feels almost like traveling together. You get to know the person really quickly. And really well. And so on this kind of journey of taking risks together, that mentor or that would-be mentor needs to see something special in you to want to commit to a meaningful way of actually supporting you. And something special in medtech, from my perspective, is to see an entrepreneur with a desire, with a drive, with a tenacity to innovate and improve lives and healthcare.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I know you and I have talked about some of the key principles and lessons that really help you along that path. And I wonder if you can talk about some of those.
Yeah, I think there are probably too many to cover, honestly. But one of the places that I've actually learned a lot is when you asked me to actually do this podcast with you, which I didn't know about this podcast, by the way, before then. I've listened to a number of them, and I'm realizing that there are a lot of embedded lessons. It's one of the essences of this process of kind of figuring out what's the right thing to do is to learn from the trials and tribulations of others that have actually gone through it. I would say if you're willing to basically stick with the principles of kind of doing the right things that and follow those lessons and principles, I would say you're more likely to be able to see tremendous opportunities. The likelihood basically dramatically increases.
You've talked about the importance of scale and impact as two of the key principles. And can you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, so I actually recognized the impact of scale basically when I was working at ACS. So this goes back to early 1990s, basically. I was working, as I mentioned in the previous podcast, with Professor Ulrich Sigvart and Lilip Lau and a tremendous group of pioneering engineers, basically. And then I actually got to observe leaders who were blazing the trail at the time, Ginger, Howard Graham, and Ron Dollins from the business standpoint at ACS, were first leaders who kind of gave me a sense of this combination of authenticity, care, engagement with the team, the courage that they have, and the decisiveness to actually move forward. So ACS really became this place where I saw that a company can actually be hyper growth and organically innovative at the same time, which really created an atmosphere for a lot of extraordinary medical innovations at the time. And this is kind of when I saw the combination of these two, it really kind of dawned on me at the time that it's not a great medical innovation unless it ends up helping a lot of patients. Otherwise, it's just a great invention. And we saw that at ACS. I mean, there are a lot of new ideas started, but only a few made it through into the clinic and into actually becoming products that are today helping patients 3 decades later. So that, I think, is one of the key principles that when you're kind of looking at innovation, the scale side of it and the fact that it needs to be able to help a lot of patients is really an important part of the continuum of innovation. It's not separate from innovation itself. Obviously, if you don't intend to build critical mass, and most medtech companies don't, the multinationals, medtechs, effectively become part of this continuum of innovation. They are the ones that can actually take technologies that have been where there's evidence that's shown that the technology actually works and could help a lot of patients. They can actually bring those capabilities of scale to the table. The second part of it, Jeff, I would say, is obviously it's scale, but it's also in the technology itself. It's about significant need and real patient impact. Those things really do matter. If I would say that if you're working on a technology, if you hold that as the true north, basically, all of the other pieces of the puzzle will probably fall into place. So from my perspective, let me just kind of maybe give a perspective of how it works. I feel like the focus on significant patient impact really compels us to be evidence-based. And we know, we've learned over the last 3 decades of medtech that evidence is really one of the key critical pillars of what we're actually doing. It identifies the pitfalls along the way and allows you to basically overcome them. And effectively, this kind of thinking allows an innovator to put a track in the mountain. And then I feel like once you put that track in the mountain, there is going to be other innovators that would actually take that track and really build a highway on that. And this is how technologies kind of grown and they reach their summit, if you will. I had mentioned to you in the last podcast, intraocular lenses is a great example of that. 25 million of them today are implanted around the world, basically. And back when I was working on it, there were about 5,000. So it takes a lot to really bring a technology forward. The scale is important. The impact of the technology is important. And I think evidence is a critical pillar of this process from my perspective.
I wonder, you know, it's such an important point. I wonder if we could pause on it for a moment, because, you know, you and I mean, you are a true entrepreneur. I get to work with entrepreneurs, and I'm sure we are both continuously meeting people who believe they have products and innovations that can impact a large number of people. They believe that there's going to be a significant patient impact. But you and I, I'm sure, come into contact with people where the reality is that it is not compelling, maybe enough to really become a standalone company, for instance. And I'm wondering, is there like a, as you've gone through it in both your own process or as you advise other entrepreneurs, are there any kind of litmus tests that you do to say whether this indeed is going to impact enough patients, or indeed it is a big enough need and the impact is going to be great enough to validate the whole effort around it?
Yeah, Jeff, I think you have to be really honest about it. This is where intellectual honesty really comes to play. falling in love with one's own technology isn't going to necessarily make them needed by millions of patients, basically. And so I think being intellectually honest about it is really critically important. So at Incept, and this is what I know there are other ways these kind of technologies get filtered, if you will, in the investment process. But at Incept, we boast about the fact that in the 25 companies that we've started in the last 25 years, we've never really shut a company down. But we end up actually killing a lot of ideas within that early stage of Incept's involvement before we actually go take anybody else's money. So we have a little bit of a seed funding within Incept that we go really beat the ideas up. And we I don't think even 50% of what we start with really gets through to actually becoming a company where we go fund it and move it forward. But once we actually do that, then there is a full commitment of getting it out there and finding the solutions and making sure that the technology really ends up being helpful. If the first aspect of the technology is not helpful, then you go actually develop a second version of it. I mean, Access Closure, one of the companies that I started with my partner, Incept partner, Amar Sahani, we developed a hydrogel closure technology. It was a liquid gel, and it was a very elegant solution, but it took about 3 minutes for the gel to congeal, and that was just too long for physicians to actually wait in the cath lab for that closure to take place. And we even got that product approved, went through a full clinical study, and then with Amar's help, we actually came in with a more of a drier, desiccated, lyophilized version of the gel that we could actually just deliver to the site, and then it would take up water and would congeal right in place, and then reducing the wait time to less than a minute, so to speak, for the physicians, which was then acceptable. And then all of a sudden, we started commercializing that technology, that really became the preferred choice for closure in a meaningful way, and eventually took the number one position in the U.S., which also right before that led to a big litigation with St. Jude Medical with their technology, basically. But eventually that technology prevailed everything because it actually worked. And the previous technology, which was pretty cool, it also worked, but it didn't really work, didn't really meet those specific specifications that was acceptable to the clinical community. And therefore, it was not, it was a no-go. And again, even though we had actually completed a pivotal trial, had spent $25 million on it, we decided to actually not launch that technology. It actually became a subject of a Harvard business case study, so to speak.
Mm. It brings up, you know, I have this working theory that, and I'm curious to see what you think about it, but I think sometimes a lot of what we see, particularly on the East Coast, is technologies coming out of universities that start with the technology, not with the market. And I wonder what you, and some of the problems I see with that is that you're then searching for the right market and you're trying to sort of fit that technology into the market rather than doing it market first and then come up with the technology. But what's interesting just in this discussion is obviously this hydrogel had a lot of different applications. And so you actually had the technology and then were able to find the right markets for it. How do you approach it? Are you a market first person, or do you think it's actually possible to have the technology first and then find the right market?
I actually think it's really more of a focusing on making sure that there's really bigger impact that you can actually make with the technology. And I think that effectively makes it more of a market first perspective in how you do this. And it's starting from the end in mind and working backwards, as opposed to starting from where you are and being hopeful that the market is going to be there.
Yeah. So as we talk about some of these great innovations, the importance of significant patient need, of impact, I'm curious, I mean, you've had so many experiences now. What are some of the key takeaways you've had that are interesting to share? And of course, our business is as much about the people as anybody else. So I'd be especially curious about the people that have had an impact on you.
Yeah, Jeff, I think, as you know, the business of innovation in medicine is a, I would call it a perilous road fraught with high highs and low lows. And I sometimes call it, it's a lot of pain and suffering with occasional kind of stopping points of success, if you're doing it right, so to speak. And so I think the way I would look at this, and one of the points that I really wanted to leave here, and by the way, Paul Yock and I at Stanford BioDesign have actually talked about this. I think it's this notion of failure, and that if you're afraid of failure as an entrepreneur, you're in the wrong business as an innovator. In other words, I would say, if you never fail, you're probably not trying hard enough, and likely not making a lot of progress, basically. So I wanted to tell you a little bit of a story. Do you mind if I kind of give you a story within a story to answer this question, maybe for you,
as opposed to
being didactic about it? So these are two stories that are very important and very special to me. They're both pivotal, and I think maybe contain some of the answer that you're looking for. In 1993, when I made my first foray into a startup, which I, by the way, didn't know what startups were, but I was excited about them. I was recruited by Mark Levin, who was really one of the pioneering healthcare venture capitalists back in the days at Mayfield Fund. Now he's the founding partner of Third Rock. And I joined his company, Focal Therapeutics. There's some really interesting stories about Mark and the special human being that he is. It's a very colorful story for me to leave my job at ACS and actually go join Focal. But the technology was essentially a hydrogel technology, a drug delivery hydrogel technology. That was what the company was built around. And I was hired to run their ophthalmic and cardiovascular engineering platforms. Watching Mark be the startup CEO was one of the most fascinating things I had ever seen in my life. Mark Levin was first to rise and kind of engage in the business. He was last to go to bed, excited about tomorrow, all the time, basically engaged with everybody. And we were small, but he was engaged with every single person that was actually in the company. I remember one morning trying to beat Mark to the office, like saying, I'm going to beat this guy to the office. I showed up at about 5:30 a.m. We had a paltry office next to MIT. Back then, the company had a handful of people, basically. I arrived, and Mark was, sure enough, was actually in his office. It's like, I'm going to use a curse word here. He was sitting behind his desk. He had his headsets on. He was talking to Asian investors, and he looked like he actually never went home that night. I personally picked the wrong day to show up because he really never went home that night. And when he saw me, he had this big beaming smile on his face. And as I stopped by his door was open. He put his call on mute and he said, "Fred, do we have anything in the office to eat?" So I ran over to the kitchen, and all we had was really a box of Cheerios and no milk. So I said, and at 5:30 in the morning, you can't really go buy him something. So took the box of Cheerios to him. And while he was still engaging on the call with the investors, he literally put his hand out and I poured a bunch of Cheerios in his hand. And he looked at me with such a smile, a kind smile of appreciation. As a 32, 33-year-old, I was really struck by that. And it made a huge impression on me. Unlikely, by the way, that Mark would probably remember this. Because it was really a pivotal moment for him. For him, it was just like who he was and what he did. For me, it was a moment of awe. The other thing at Focal that I want to tie to this story is that I also met my future mentor, business partner, Amar Sahani. I think you've interviewed Amar, and it was a phenomenal podcast, basically. Amar and I became really close in the process. And I had had some professional experience at Alcon and at ACS, and Amar was fresh, very good-natured, truly brilliant PhD out of UT Austin, who really became my future INSEP partner, which I've been feel very privileged about. And much of my entrepreneurial story really got intertwined with Amar in the process. These two stories, basically, I think, is an important one, is that of the fundamentals of if you see someone special with integrity, with intellect and with determination, hold on tight to them and do your best not to screw up that relationship. This is, by the way, something that I keep telling myself, even to this day. I keep telling myself. It takes a little ounce of humility and not being selfish or being less selfish that as you can. And it's an important principle, honestly. It really will get you through many, many doors, taking that approach in the process.
Yeah. It's such a great reminder that it's not an individual endeavor that we're on. Right. And if it were, I always say this in the investing business, that you could never invest just alone, right? You wouldn't be nearly as powerful as finding the right people to invest with. And I think that is even more important in entrepreneurship and building these companies and just really paying attention to the people around you and who you want to be, go to battle with. So that really resonates.
So true, Jeff. I think it's been... For me, it's been a recurring theme in the process, and I feel lucky that I've had the kind of presence of mind to realize how to hold on and how not to screw it up in the process as much as possible.
Yeah. So after Focal, you go back to Silicon Valley and you start a company called Endotex. And that was actually inspired by Mark and the folks at Focal. But I wonder if you could talk about that and some of what you learned there.
Yeah, I think that's another really important lesson, which goes back to your previous question. Again, it really boils down to kind of the notion of failure and how you get up from it. I was, by the way, when we started Endotex, and I started Endotex with Dr. Mark Woolley and Professor Sigvart, basically, to develop the first carotid stent and a AAA stent graft, basically using a platform stent technology that we had. And Mark Woolley, the legendary Mark Woolley, every time he would see me, he would consistently ask me, Fred, are you surrounded by the right people? And eventually I realized, looking back, that the reality was no, but like any first-time CEO, Jeff, the first-time startup CEO, I defended myself and I defended my choices. And I also felt like that in that experience, which really became a pivotal experience for me, I was so focused on pleasing the investors and my board as opposed to really objectively partner with them, understanding what it is that each one of them could actually bring to the table so that we can actually weave this quilt of support in going forward. I was really looking at them as parents, not partners. And so the dynamic really changes between an entrepreneur and their board if you've got this parent versus partner approach. And so being that I wasn't doing my job to actually understand how to utilize them as partners, they kept coming back to me with information that you got to take your company public. You got to get it ready to take it public. This was the late 90s, the heydays of the companies going public. And I actually listened to them because, again, it was a more of a parent-child relationship instead of partnership, if you will. And so we ended up neglecting the product and focused on building the company towards the goal that the investors wanted. And this is where that notion of it's not really a great medical innovation that we were talking about at the beginning, unless it ends up helping a lot of patients. Otherwise, it's just a great invention. That's where basically it really played itself out. The product really didn't work. The company nearly failed, and I personally felt like an utter failure as an entrepreneur. I remember going home and sitting down, kind of almost my head between my legs, with talking to my wife about the level of pain of that failure. But you know what? I persevered. I ended up feeling, even though I felt like I had failed as a CEO, I felt like the technology has to work. The technology should not fail. And so while I was really utterly disappointed in myself, that became the purpose that got me back on the saddle. And I just basically went ahead and with my board at that point, it quickly became more of a partnership as opposed to the parent-child relationship, basically with conflict and with more of a near-death experience. It became a partnership. So we brought a new CEO, John Maroney, who I ended up learning a ton from along the way. I gave the company my support as a chief technology officer to turn the technology around. And we ended up getting the first carotid stent in the United States approved through a landmark IDE clinical trial. And eventual acquisition by Boston Scientific. All along, by the way, as this was going on, I carried my personal failure with me, and that kind of never went away.
Yeah, and maybe just to talk about that for a moment. So, because I often think in entrepreneurship, you need to be like a good relief pitcher, right? You can't have a long memory. that will maybe hinder you. But in this case, I think the point you're making, a really interesting one, is you carry it, but you don't let it hold you back. Is that right? And so
yeah, I think what I did was I was able to compartmentalize my own personal failings as a CEO. What I thought was my own personal failings as a CEO, but say, I'm still the technology guy. I'm still going to make this happen. And we actually went ahead and did. I ended up working with an extraordinary engineer by the name of Yi Yang, who joined us from Boston Scientific. And we're working together. He's now the chief about 25 years later. He's the chief technology officer at Imperative Care, the company that I'm running. And it just became a very profound relationship with us. By the way, Lilip is also at Imperative Care. So we have some long-lasting, multi-decade relationships that we've actually created. But Yi and I worked together and basically, and he brought a significant amount of ingenuity to it, basically. And we actually turned the technology around and made it clinically useful, which was really important. That was gratifying. But the feeling of failure as a CEO kind of never went away until I basically started as the company was getting into clinicals and the technology was back on track. I was starting to step away a little bit and started working with an old friend, really, really tremendous friend and brilliant engineer. We worked together at ACS with Amr Saleh here on basic prototyping of a carotid filter technology. And the spell that was on me where I felt like it was basically taken off. It was this particular meeting that I was going to kind of tell you the story about. I was invited by one of my former Endotex investors, Rob Cooling from Onset Ventures, to go have lunch with him at his office. I was excited to see Rob. And Rob, pretty quickly during the lunch, he asked me, "So, Fred, what are you doing these days?" And I was a bit reluctant to actually respond to him. So, and the reason I was reluctant is that because I was seeing myself as a failure, I assumed that Rob, as my investor, he was seeing me the same way as well. And I thought he kind of sees me as the guy who wrecked this company. So I was being quite evasive about it. He kind of looked at me and he goes, "Fred, I'm having a hard time believing that you're not working on anything." I said, "Well, I'm actually working on something, but Rob, you don't want to invest in me. I almost wrecked your last company." And Rob paused, and this really became an important pivotal moment for me. If you recall, Jeff, as powerful as the moment that I had with the lady who was flying from Huntington to Atlanta, who had gained her eyesight back from those intraocular lenses. Mm. And it oriented me in the medical device direction. Rob basically told me, and I'm getting goosebumps talking about this, honestly. Rob basically says, "Fred, is that really what you think? If you're thinking that us VCs are looking for sure bets as entrepreneurs that succeed all the time, you're totally wrong. The kind of entrepreneurs that we're looking for are those guys who actually have the courage, willing to fail, willing to pick themselves back up, dust themselves off, get back on the saddle, and still go forward until they actually succeed." And he said, "You did that for us at Endotex." And for that, he said, "I'm actually willing to write a $500,000 check." Back then, that was a lot of money, by the way. This is 1998 we're talking about. He goes, "I'll write you a $500,000 check. You don't even have to tell me what it is. Just send me the paperwork."
Mm.
Incredible. For me, it was landmasses were moving, basically. My reaction was one of bewilderment and real reflection. And then it really set the next 2 decades for me. Even to this date, I'm talking to Rob always, and I remind him of that lesson and how critical was that for me. Bottom line, I would say, Jeff, is that courage as an innovator gives the person the urgency to get back up, to dust yourself off, learn what is to be learned, and go at it again. It's really the main ingredients that I would say turns an innovator, it turns an inventor into an innovator.
Yeah. But raises so many important points. I mean, the really interesting one to me is this interaction between entrepreneur and board. And I think so often, you know, CEOs look to manage information to their boards or manage their boards, kind of manage upward, as it were, versus really collaborating with the board. And I've always felt like it, particularly in venture capital, you have this free resource as a CEO around you, which is your board. And to not sort of tap into that is, you know, you're really selling yourself short or selling the company short. And it sounds to me from what you're saying is that that switch you made to really start treating the board as resources versus people that you needed to, you know, please or what have you, it was a really critical switch in mindset.
It was pivotal for me, Jeff. I look at it as I think the job of a CEO of a startup is to turn his or her board into a quilt of support to achieve the mission, as opposed to a policing function. Mm. It's just, by the way, it's not just the job of the CEO. It's also the board members, the investors have equal responsibility. Right, because they're sitting on the high seats, if you will, and so it's the responsibility of everyone to actually create that. But it needs to that all of that experience that's around the table really needs to turn into a quilt of support to achieve the mission.
Yeah, and another mistake I see happen sometimes is you know a CEO feels like he's reporting to one board member who might have, you know, might have a lot of ownership or might be particularly forceful in their opinions. But, and I always try to say, you know, you don't report to any one board member. And as we're saying, you know, the whole relationship shouldn't be one of reporting anyhow, but no one board member really controls anything. It's, you know, the importance of collaborating and working together for the company's sake is what matters. And I'm curious if you have situations like that or that's something that you counsel other CEOs on.
Yeah, no, I think you, it is really true. Someone, I mean, some of your board members own more of your company. Some of your board members are the louder ones than the quieter ones, so to speak. And I think, again, I go back to this notion that it is incumbent upon the CEO to figure out. It's a company does really well when a CEO doesn't manage the board per se, but manage this kind of notion and relationship of the board to be able to actually amalgamate the sum total of the value that everybody brings to the table.
Yeah. And then another concept that, you know, this raises is just the importance of, you know, and I think it's something that we talk a lot about, but I'm, you know, I'm curious as to, you know, how you really put it into practice, but this concept of failing early and failing fast and not, you know, as you said, not going public before the product actually works. So that to me, it seems like a really important concept.
It is. But I'm so happy that some of the things that happened to me were early in my career, basically, because it really set the course for the future. But I think it goes back to that earlier notion, Jeff, that we were talking about is just if you're afraid of failure, you don't move. And it just the clock kind of the time keeps ticking. Right. And you may be going sideways. It's better to move forward and it's better to be courageous enough to take a step. If your intentions are right, if you're focused on the right stuff, if you're focused on evidence, if you're focused on data and the right technologies that improve kind of quality of care and standards, basically. Then you might just move and fail early and be able to kind of put Humpty Dumpty back together again and create something something meaningful in the process. Otherwise, if you're afraid of doing that, if you're afraid of being courageous to move forward, it just takes a lot of time, and you end up going sideways. And when you look back, there's a lot of road behind you and no accomplishments ahead.
Yeah. Well, since you mentioned the filter technology and the work with Amr, I have to ask what ended up happening to that filter technology?
So actually there, Jeff, what I learned was the strong linkage with the clinical community in developing a technology. The first experience that I had was with Professor Sigvart at ACS. And for the filter, we ended up actually working with, partnering with Dr. Nick Hopkins, who was the chief of neurosurgery at University of Buffalo. Nick, by the way, has since become one of my all-time mentors, clinical visionary partner, friend, brother. And we've been working together for 2.5 decades. Nick really brought, while Amr Salehia was the brilliant engineer who was actually working with me, and we started EPI together with Nick. Nick really brought the clinical perspective, and he was willing to actually be out there and continue looking at the technology and beating it up until we got to a place where we created something meaningful for the patients. But I also kind of bringing the collective of all of these experiences that I've had in the decade before, I also ended up kind of beginning to build my board of directors. And one of the guys who really became almost the chairman of the board of my own board of directors is Hank Plain, who was then the CEO of PerClose at the time. And PerClose was a vascular closure technology which went public, and then it was acquired by Abbott. Hank's essentially served as my friend and mentor, a sage business mentor in the process. So bringing all of this together and having somebody from a business standpoint who cares about you, who keeps reminding you that it's not about the transaction, it's about actually getting the right products to the patients, having a clinician who actually comes in and beats it up and makes sure that it actually is the right product, was actually, from my perspective, a game changer. It allowed us to actually take that idea of the filter from the idea to the clinic and to exit in a matter of 18 months. It was eventually acquired by Boston Scientific, and for something in excess of about 30 times the $5 million of capital that we had invested in the company. And the EPI filter wire to this date remains, a quarter century later, remains the number one intravascular filter in the global market. So I think the linkage with the medical community and product development, along with kind of the system of standards that we have, the regulatory insight, oversights that we have, is what really makes American medical technology the most advanced and sought after in the world. And this was a great example for me to see that happen and see a technology that I, not a technology that I was working for Alcon or ACS, but a technology that I had a part in actually starting to get to that level of scale and global impact.
And I want to get into actually something you just said around kind of what makes our ecosystem here so attractive. But before we do that, I also want to talk a little bit about Incept and your partnership with Amr, because I think in the background here, or maybe even before EPI, you were starting to work with Amr and Incept. Or tell us what was that happening already, or what was the sequence of events?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm kind of the sequence of events are a little complicated, but it played out a little complicated too, because I think the creation of EPI and Incept effectively became simultaneous. There was a little bit of a chicken and egg story in it, but I'm not sure whether Amar or I can say which was the chicken or which was the egg, honestly. But yes, as I was starting EPI, Amar left Focal. He had been kind of feeling a little bit stir crazy. The company was acquired by Genzyme. Now he was in a bit bigger company, basically, and he was contemplating his next move. We got together in the Bay Area, and we started actually talking through, and eventually began creating, putting a framework around the concept of Incept. And where it all stemmed from, Jeff, is that Amar was a tremendous entrepreneur, a really an amazing, a brilliant quick study in the process, and I had seen it in action. He had seen things at Focal in the process of Focal getting started on licensing the technology, and how Focal actually ended up getting acquired by Genzyme, that he wanted to change. I had the kind of the near catastrophe of Endotex and was really create on was really trying to create innovative companies, which the company wasn't about me as it was in the early parts of Endotex, but about the clinical mission, which is the key aspect of what I learned from the Endotex adversity. So we decided to actually, Amar and I decided to pool forces. Honestly, neither one of us knew what we were doing, and create Incept as an accelerator to cultivate medical device innovation and entrepreneurial leadership. And simultaneous with EPI, we also, Amar started a company called Confluent Surgical. So both EPI, Confluent, and Incept all effectively formed at the same time. And essentially, this year that we've just actually come into, 2023, is the 25th anniversary of that time that we actually started the company. Just a little, maybe a bit of a background on Incept, Jeff. We over the last 25 years, we've actually started 25 companies, and in turn, these companies have actually created products that every year treat over about 1 million patients around the world. And I think the other thing that we realized early on in the process, just from all of our experiences, that in the process, if you're going to be a serial entrepreneur, which is what we wanted to do, work together to be able to start a number of companies, we also really believe that you have to cultivate leadership, because each person can run one company at a time. And so I feel like that is the essence of entrepreneurship, is cultivating leadership and not just technologies. And we really focused on a lot of the elements of making sure that our companies are diverse in thinking, basically, in gender, in experience, in ethnicity, in expertise. Again, this kind of a quilt of support that I was talking about. I think we recognized really early in the process and through our past experiences that diversity really allows for broader reasoning, for great ideas, thoughtful ideas, and a sensible belief system to come together. And it really, what it really does, which is why I'm excited to go to work still every day, 30 some years after I started working at Alcon, basically, is the ability to be able to actually create a speak up culture around you. It's a little harder to manage a speak up culture because obviously people speak up, But at the end, what it does is that it actually fosters a more enduring set of value systems where everybody feels like they belong and they have a seat at the table and they have a voice basically in the process. That really creates quite a bit of ownership. So if I were to describe INCEPT and how it started and what it really meant, I think that probably is kind of hopefully captures it.
Yeah. And I love this idea of a speak up culture. I mean, it's one thing I always kind of laugh about is when somebody says, you know, let me ask a dumb question, my ears always perk up because usually that's the question that, you know, other people are afraid to ask. It's not a dumb question at all. It's usually a question that really helps uncover something. And so allowing for people to really be able to ask the quote unquote dumb questions, which are probably the smart questions, is so important.
That's really interesting, Jeff. I never actually thought about it that way. That when somebody says, can I ask a dumb question? That's the question that everybody else wants to ask, but they're afraid of asking.
Yeah.
Right. I'll take that back from this this conversation.
Well, let's touch on something that you mentioned previously, because I want to talk a little bit more about sort of our American medtech ecosystem and maybe elaborate a little bit on it, because we can kind of complain a lot about the FDA or Medicare. I mean, there's no doubt that it's a challenging system, but I wonder if you can elaborate a little bit on what makes our ecosystem so sought after.
Jeff, I really want to thank you for bringing us back to this topic, because this is really one of my favorite topics to talk about. It's a road less traveled. We don't talk in this way about medtech, but I happen to believe medtech is really indigenous to the United States, kind of a vertical of innovation, and continues to be very much a U.S. kind of a focused, dominated set of technologies and innovation. And let me also say that I'm not saying this from a position of national arrogance, basically. I'm saying this because in my humble 3 decades plus of experience is that, and I've worked in many hospitals in many parts of the world, remote and also in Western Europe, anywhere in the world, if you have a choice of an American medical device that is available and affordable, the American medical device always ends up being the preferred choice for the patient, by the patient, and actually by the physician and for the patient, I should say. I think there are two factors in that. One factor is just the correlation between the notion of freedom, the ability to think innovatively and feel free to actually think openly, and innovation. That's one correlation that I think, exists. Some people may, kind of react to it. I know this part of our conversation may actually be faced with a lot of criticisms, basically. But I really believe that there is a strong correlation. I think there's data actually that shows that, but we don't have ways to actually show charts and what have you here. But there's a significant correlation between freedom and innovation. But second, when it comes to medical devices, American medical technology is the most sought after because there are common sense regulations. And I know some people will actually debate the common sense aspect of it and talking about the burden of regulatory process and what have you. But at the end of the day, and I agree with them, by the way, I'm not in disagreement that sometimes it's burdensome and we need to kind of work with the FDA. There's got to be public-private partnerships that identify those burdens, basically. But I really believe Jeff, that it's the high quality standards that we have that are basically regulated is what makes American technology the highest quality in the world, basically. Those high quality standards, from my perspective, are the guideposts and the harnesses that are set to ensure the direction of the quality standards for U.S. med tech is only one way, in the direction of highest quality. But I think the only way this kind of a regime of regulation actually works is that there's got to be a commitment to appropriate funding for the FDA so that it actually continues to have sustained growth to continue basically reflecting the complexity of life sciences. I mean, when I look at life sciences back in the late 1980s and today, and I've seen both ends of it, I feel like we're not in Kansas anymore. I think FDA probably feels like we're not in Kansas anymore. We gotta basically grow. The FDA needs to grow and have the commitment of appropriate funding to evolve. I also think that the reimbursement policies that are in place need to evolve and need to be more nimble with changing standards and the care that our patients need, basically. So these are important elements that are kind of need to be in place that avoid penalizing early adopters for new technologies. And I think that that's really critical. The two other aspects of what I wanted to just comment on this topic, and then I'll stop, is that I feel like the medtech innovation really being indigenous to the United States, we need to strengthen the regime of federal research and development tax credits for this space. We need to encourage venture financing for emerging life sciences companies with kind of whatever means of federal level angel investment tax credit that could be actually placed. This is the way to really renewing American innovation as we go forward. We're moving in the direction that healthcare is going to be a dominant area of innovation going forward. And more importantly, staying away, having these kind of wrong-headed kind of innovation impending policies like the medical device tax, basically. But I would say that no matter what your political persuasion is, as divided as we are in this country, and I it pains me to see how divided we are, I think we can agree on one thing, that we are all lucky to be living in a country, to be able to think freely, because really free thinking is, from my perspective, the fountainhead of innovation. And as an immigrant, in my case, fleeing an autocratic theocracy, you never take that for granted, that the American system uniquely allows us to pursue directions and paths to innovation and progress that is honestly unlike anywhere else in the world.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't agree more. And I think it's so well stated. And maybe just to wrap up here, one thing I'd love to hear a bit more about is what's happening at INCEPT. I wonder if you could give a sketch of at least a couple of the companies that are that INCEPT has given birth to and they're making progress.
Yeah, well, I think our time may be running out, but I would say that INCEPT is Right now, 8 companies currently privately held. Amar and I have been busy creating these companies, but really at the heart and soul of our Incept companies are extraordinary leaders that are running these companies. That we not only help cultivate, but in time, we end up actually, these leaders end up being people that both Amar and I looking up to as and their the significant entrepreneurial prowesses that they pick up along the way. Also, I think one of the important things that we do is the shared sense of community with the teams that we develop basically around this vision of basically improving lives in every company. The teams really are the key part of this process. They're not just the engine, but they're an important ingredient to the process. So we're very grateful to this community that at Incept that has been created. To talk about, we may not have time to go through these, but I'll maybe highlight a few companies. Axtria, which is a New Jersey-based privately held company run by an extraordinary leader, Jesse Chadha, and Amar's basically sitting on Jesse's board, has created a billion-dollar big data company, thousands of employees in U.S. and India, and really seamlessly blending information, analytics, cloud technology to focus on life sciences and life sciences commercial businesses, basically, to gain competitive edge through data. On the other end of the spectrum, we have a very small company called Osteal, which has around 10 employees, run by John Bohane, who's been a steadfast leader in many of our Incept companies, that is focused on a balloon technology for aorto-osteal stenting. The technology has been used in 20,000 patients so far. Really, really exciting tool in the arsenal of cardiologists and interventionists. We've made a bit of a foray into the digital health space, and we're really, really excited about that, working with an extraordinary CEO by the name of Leo Petrosian at a company called Neurolutions, which is developing a brain-computer interface robot to heal stroke patients from their motor disabilities. This is a technology that emerged out of WashU by Drs. Eric Luthard and Dan Moran. It's a really exciting technology. Just recently received 510K and breakthrough designation, and the company is actually gearing up for reimbursement and commercialization. In your neck of the woods in Boston, Amar has another company called Instilla, run by an extraordinary veteran in medtech, Ray LaRue, who's the CEO of the company. And the company is actually focused on two pivotal landmark clinical studies with hydrogel technology, which is an area of forte of Amar's, basically. One of them for embolization of tumors and another one for bleeding cessation. I have a privilege of here in the Bay Area working with an extraordinary scientific leader, CEO, Corinne Bright, of a company called Tulavi Therapeutics, where she's effectively building a platform of technology for nerve repair. Again, it goes back to Amar's hydrogel technology, but Corinne is actually evolving it into a set of very unique and innovative technologies that actually bring predictability to nerve care during surgery and prevent painful neuromas for nerves that are affected by surgical intervention. The youngest company of ours is a company called Reneva, literally got established in a garage in San Jose with a group of extraordinary and talented engineers and leaders, very small, but very mighty, that are actually developing a very early stage mitral valve repair company, where obviously it's a little bit stealthy to talk more about it, but that's kind of the direction of the technology. And then Imperative Care is the company that I'm running, and really what gets me out of bed every morning, obviously along with everything else that we're doing at INSEP. But this one is an important one that we've actually started, that I started with Dr. Nick Hopkins. And it's built really as a standalone comprehensive stroke and thrombectomy care company. Our plan is for Imperative Care to really become the preeminent company in the continuum of stroke and thrombectomy care. It's just to give you a little bit of a backdrop on specifics of Imperative, which is one of the farthest along companies that we have in INSEP. Since 2016, when we actually founded the company, we've actually taken our stroke business commercial. We've treated over 20,000 patients in only 3 years from full launch of our Zoom stroke solution. We expect the business by the middle of the decade to take a very solid leadership position. And we intend to actually do this, Jeff, through surrounding patients with all things stroke and thrombectomy care. It is Imperative is an unusual setup in our INSEP portfolio, in the sense that Imperative itself is the parent company of four different business units. Two of these business units are actually commercial. Our stroke business, as I mentioned, launched in 2020. Our peripheral thrombectomy business has begun its initial early launch rollout in late 2022 into 23. And then there are two other businesses that are actually organized under Imperative Care that are earlier stage, long-term developments that we're making. One of them in the digital health space, basically, for stroke survivors, called CanDo Health. And another one is a robotic platform for stroke treatment called Telos Health. And maybe a few more metrics I can give you. We're headquartered in a 100,000 square foot facility in Campbell near San Jose, 450 employees across the four platforms. Our headcount has doubled over the last year, and we've raised in excess of about $375 million in equity financing to really build this broader continuum of care story. And the reason behind it is that the continuum of care of stroke and thrombectomy is really quite siloed. The patients are the only constant in as they go from one disconnected silo to another disconnected silo. So early on, as we were envisioning creating Imperative Care, with which, by the way, initially was called the Stroke Project, with doctors Nick Hopkins, Quill Turk, Jay Mako, and Adnan Siddiqui, we kind of recognized that this is a global problem. That to address it, you need to kind of think about it with the perspective of connected care requires connected innovation, which effectively means that whenever innovation and technology can bring more and higher quality care to more patients, or more patients to more high quality care, we need to consider being invested in. So that's kind of a, more of a thumbnail sketch of Imperative and some of the other companies. I hope it's helpful.
Yeah, it's incredible. And, you know, I think what you're doing it imperative. I mean, I think there's so much that we can learn from it for every discipline and every company. Because we, you know, so often I think in our healthcare system, we get compensated on procedural success, but really the ultimate patient outcome, and stroke is an important example of this, because just because you have procedural success doesn't mean the patient's going to regain all their function. But to really integrate all of that and really be focused on ultimately getting that patient back to a high performing level, or as high as they can be, and having the company behind that, that seems really compelling. So congratulations on the effort and progress there. And I really want to, go ahead, Fred.
Really appreciate it, Jeff. I think it is really important. I always say that it's a little bit of a back to the future model, in the sense that if we go back to the beginning of the conversation that we had, this notion of a hyper growth company that can actually invest in long-term technologies that actually create more of an interconnected care, basically an interconnected innovation, if you will, for interconnected care, really goes back to the days of ACS, those early medical device companies that were being created, Meditech and ACS and Medtronic and many others, basically, that were formed in the late 1980s and 1990s. They were focused on the patient, on the patient continuum, not just on a it wasn't just a hammer and nail type of way of looking at the technology. Our healthcare system has gone in that direction. It's mm-hmm. become very subspecialized. But I think the future really belongs in healthcare to those people who actually look at the patient as a constant and a part of the continuum, basically, and try to figure out ways to actually create and make interconnected care happen.
Yeah. Well, Fred, it's been a true pleasure. These are lessons and insights that I think everybody's going to benefit from. I know I have in our time together, and I really, really sincerely appreciate you joining me on the podcast.
I very much appreciate you, Jeff, and this you've been a phenomenal host. I enjoy very much talking to you. So, thank you for making this a very pleasant exercise, and I'm learning from you as well.
Well, thank you.